Welcome to the Rad Season Action Sports Podcast. I'm Ollie Russell Cowan, and we are joined by an industry legend, pro snowboarder, action sports commentator, podcaster, and entrepreneur, Todd Richards. Todd grew up in Paxton, Massachusetts, and got into skateboarding and punk rock. Skating was one of the first things that Todd was passionate about, and he could see progression happening, and that was the backbone for everything. Snowboarding came along initially as something to do during the winter months when the vert ramps got too icy to skate. A friend introduced him to competing right at the time when the birth of snowboarding halfpipes started. The rest is history. Todd went on to win multiple X Games medals, two US Open halfpipe titles, and was on the first ever US halfpipe team at the Winter Olympics in 98. Nowadays, Todd hosts Monday Mass with his friend Chris Cote, commentates on various action sports and skateboarding and snowboarding events such as the Dew Tour, Jackalope Festival, and the Olympics for NBC. He works for Quicksilver on marketing and is part of the Sports Management Mastermind course and has a number of investment ventures. There's so much to dissect in this episode. We're going to be talking about how Todd got into snowboarding, what it was like competing in the Olympics, his career change, becoming a commentator, preserving snowboarding's culture, and loads more. Let's jump into it.
Hey, Todd. How are you, man?
Good, man. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thanks. Thanks for coming on the show. You're over in Encinitas at home, right?
Yeah, I'm in Encinitas, California. Yep. It's what we call locals summer right now when all the tourists go home, but we still have the good weather and about half the people in the water. So it's very nice.
And how's the surf been? Is it still been pretty good?
It's been good. I mean, we've had a really good run, kind of a late summer over here, but things are just starting. Like I said, there's not as many people around anymore. So even if the surf's not good, it's still a lot better than it was, even if it was summertime and really crowded. So this is the time of year that I live for, basically.
It's good, huh? It's kind of the same here, like over in Portugal, sort of, you know, schools have gone back and, you know, all the grommets are kind of out of the water, sort of.
Yep.
During the day and stuff. And then, people are sort of back into routine. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Sure.
It's all good. Cool, man. And what have you been working on recently? You've been kind of traveling a bit, haven't you?
In the summertime, we do skateboard events, whether it be Dew Tour. I just did something in Montreal called the Jackalope Festival.
Nice.
Been kind of working on doing this thing with Sue Izzo and Cersei Wallace, which is a kind of like a mentoring program, like a mastermind class thing, mentoring program to kind of help some of these kids that are coming up that want to chase the dream of competition and maybe going to the Olympics, or they really want to figure out how to navigate the industry in terms of being sponsored and things like that. So we offer a class for them, and we try to help them avoid some of the pitfalls and stuff. So I've been working on that too. And just basically, we have a podcast every Monday that we do, and it just seems like there's a lot going on at all times over here.
Nice, man. And with that sports management course, that's like across different action sports, right? So
yeah,
it's kind of whether it's skate, snow, surf.
Yeah. And even, ski, BMX, we kind of figured that as far as what it takes to pursue things like that to the highest level and to get the support while you're on your journey, it's kind of the same across, all the different sports and even into mainstream sports as well, because as we know now, it's all about what your social media presence is, who you are, not just the sport you do, because now every single kid that's 14 years old is way better than we were when we were at the peak of us being pro. So it's really about like who you craft yourself into, as far as like who you are really and what the public really gets to know.
Yeah. And then that's sort of like going into, having a personality and kind of standing out as well. Right.
And
kind of,
yeah. And it's weird because, we're trying to offer this service where I'd never want to like coach someone into having a persona, but I guess what we're really trying to do is saying it's okay to be yourself and to embrace that. Don't try to fit into any kind of a little mold that you think you need to be, because I think these days people are really, if you're genuine, people can really tell. And I think that's what actually, you know, drives the public.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of them kind of feel that they're like, if they're pigeonholing themselves into like a certain, like you're saying, like a persona through social and stuff, or?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of kids especially, and their parents, tend to think they know who they should be, you know, and oftentimes that's not the reality. You know, it's what we see on social media, whether it be TikTok, Instagram, whatever, you're getting such a small snapshot of oftentimes a made up persona. And that's, yeah, you know, it's really hard to keep that going. You know, like if you start that way and then you have to keep going with this weird persona that you've made for yourself, but that's not who you really are. It just sounds, yeah, exhausting. So we just try to give like different avenues for people to, like, you know, really embrace who you are, and it's and to navigate the space within our industries properly, I guess.
Yeah. And that will be all sort of all the lessons learned, right? I mean, you know, there's none of that when we were growing up, right?
It's no, like, I mean, we fell down the stairs so that you can walk down the stairs smoothly. That's the way I like to put it.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
And how was, like, sort of, I mean, like talking about growing up, like, because you grew up like over on the East Coast in, mm-hmm, in Paxton, and mm-hmm, skating was kind of like the first sort of outlet, right?
Yeah, I mean, skateboarding, for myself, I wasn't particularly very good at anything when I was growing up. I had a really vivid imagination. I loved to, you know, play with elaborate scenarios with my toys. But, you know, when I went into high school, I wasn't very tall, wasn't very strong, was kind of a stunted adolescence a little bit. And I just didn't fit into any box. So when skateboarding came along, initially it was listening to punk rock music, and skateboarding kind of came along with that. It was the first thing that I was actually like passionate about, and really I could like see progress happening, and I liked to chase that progress. So yeah, grew up skating, and that was the backbone for all of it, you know?
And that was vert skating as well, wasn't it? So there was wasn't there like a ramp like in your town and...
Yeah. I mean, this is pre street skating. Street skating at that point was going to the ramp from wherever it was you were. Like, there wasn't, you know, it was just in its infancy as far as what we think about modern street skating today. But yeah, there was a ramp in my town, and I went there, and that's where the older kids hung out, the older punk rock kids. And it was a very eye-opening experience for a young kind of sheltered youth from suburban New England to see all these people come from different parts of New England to come together, basically like a gathering of the tribes. And man, some of these dudes were wild back then.
And would they be sort of pushing you and like, you know, like, you know, younger guys and
pushing? No, it was more like, they were like super discouraging. Like, they just wanted us to go away. Yeah. It was like, we were just like little kids that were just in the way. And they just kind of saw us as, you know, just like a nuisance. But yeah, we were also dedicated to skating and what they represented and who they were and just their flying the bird to society and whatever societal norms were pushed upon them at that point in time, that we just loved that. We gravitated towards that big time. Not myself especially, because it was, you know, it's a weird time in your adolescence where you're pulling all these different influences in from all over. And it was the first one that really, really spoke to me as far as like, you know, these people are embracing like what I feel on a daily basis going to high school. I was just picked on all the time, and these guys were just like, wow. And that's exactly how I felt inside. So that it was a great match for me, you know, to follow that for sure.
And that went hand in hand with the whole punk rock scene back then.
Yeah,
as well, right?
It was one and the same. It was, you know, at that point in time, if you listen to punk rock music, chances are you had a skateboard, and, you know, it slowly kind of diverged from that where, you know, then you would see the kids who, who had a skateboard and the kids that actually skated. And that kind of showed itself, you know, pretty rapidly after that. And then it was like another subgenre of like, oh, the posers that don't skate and the people that really skate. It was just constantly branching off into these weird worlds.
Yeah. And was there like a lot of influence from over on the West Coast back then, or was it kind of, you just weren't really aware of it and sort of.
Well, I mean, we were definitely aware of what was happening in skateboarding on the West Coast just by virtue of the magazines. And I think the first real like shocking moment that I had in skateboarding was when I saw the very first Powell video, which was the Bones Brigade video show, because up until that point, we had maybe only seen skateboarding on TV, you know, in like a 2 second clip for some, these wacky kids. But when we saw that first Powell video, it blew our minds because, number one, that was the first time I saw how these people in the magazine actually did these tricks. We just saw them in the air, or you know, doing a hand plant, or you know, some trick. We didn't actually see how that occurred. And also that there was all these skate parks on the West Coast, and you know, it was such an eye-opening experience. It was crazy the way that, you know, like we're talking about pivotal points. That was another huge pivotal point, because now there was something to study and something to use as a blueprint to get better at what you're doing.
And was that something then, so like this is VHT, like VHS tapes, and then like kind of copies of Thrasher and stuff, right? And kind of just
and
it, sort of, I mean, going through those. And
you only got one tape for like 20 people. So what would happen would be is like, you know, you'd be making that's the local train going through, but you would make a copy of the copy, and that copy, you know, someone else would make a copy of that. And oftentimes you were taping over the baseball game or whatever it was, or, you know, whatever you had taped on there. It was pretty raw, pretty grassroots, as far as, you know, you would just hand down either the magazines or the videos or whatever. There was no like real skate scene. There wasn't really a skate shop where you could go and watch videos at that point. So it was very much an underground thing between a core group of people.
Nice. And wasn't it the magazines, like that was where you first kind of got a glimpse of snowboarding, was like through the ads?
It was. And, you know, I think it was the first time I'd really seen snowboarding was, I believe it was a Thrasher magazine. And it was an ad. It probably was an ad for Burton Backhill, but there maybe have been an ad. Maybe it was a Sims ad, but it was all kind of happened at the same time. I can't really remember what was the individual like catalyst for me being like, oh, that's cool. Because at this point in time, and always in New England, as soon as October comes around, it gets cold and then it starts to snow. And then the ramp that you're skating every day, it's no longer accessible every day because of snow and ice buildup and just the flip-flopping of the weather. So we were like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be our alternate to skating in the wintertime. Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't. I hated snowboarding initially. I thought it was just the dumbest thing, because you have an idea in your head of what you're going to be able to do in this thing. Now, that equipment and what we had to use the equipment on was so rudimentary that it just wasn't something for me. And I think initially I probably sold that Burton Backhill, or, you know, somebody, or traded it for a set of trucks or something. You know, it wasn't like my eureka moment. Like, I love snowboarding. Initially, it sucked, and I just didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Were you just kind of thinking of it like, you know, like what kind of tricks, what kind of skate tricks could you do, and then not being able to do it? It was kind of getting a bit frustrated. And
I think a lot of it too, you know, you had, like I said, you have this idea in your mind where I'm going to do these airs and hand plants and all this stuff. But really what it came down to is I was just wet and miserable. And it, like, that was the worst part about it, was like, I didn't have any, like, you know, I skied as like a social thing. I wasn't like, it wasn't like skiing was like my life or anything like that. So I had the clothing, but the clothing back then sucked. And snowboarding in the beginning, especially at that point in snowboarding, it wasn't very good. So you were rolling around the snow a lot. and rolling around the snow with non-waterproof stuff just makes you like a sponge. So I was like, why would I want to do this? This is stupid. Like, this is really dumb. So I ended up snowboarding socially, I would say.
Okay.
You know, I would go with my friends. Never really particularly. If I had to make a choice between, you want to go skate, you want to go snowboard, of course I would go skate. That wasn't even a thing in my mind. And it wasn't until really I went to school near a mountain, and I think it was the Sim Switchblade was the first board that made me be like, whoa, this is fun. You know, like, this is actually like the edges worked, board worked, and it became something of a passion after that. And, you know, the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. And I mean, wasn't it sort of, I mean, you were kind of like, wasn't the dream, it was to be a pro skater, right?
Like, it was, and you know, I initially, that was, it's such a pie in the sky dream. I went to school for graphic design. Pretty much everything that I learned at the design school I went to is replaced by like two keystrokes in Photoshop, you know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to be a pro skater, but I didn't, you know, it wasn't like I was serious. You know, it was just like something, I'm just going to keep getting better. Someday I could go pro. But really it was about like, how can I get free skateboard stuff? I wasn't ever thinking about like making money doing anything. And initially I moved out west from New England. I was actually on my way to San Diego when we stopped. She was going to school in Colorado, and we stopped in Boulder with this girl that I was with. And I was like, oh, this is insane. There's the weather here in the wintertime is great. You know, if I want to skate and not be in the mountains, I can go snowboarding in the mountains. And that's kind of where I just stopped. And then I think I was sponsored for snowboarding at that point, but it wasn't like I was really
chasing. This was before Sims, right? Before they sponsored.
No, this is right at the beginning of Sims. Like, okay. I still wasn't really convinced that I wanted to do, like, I liked it and it was really fun, but I still had this dream of going to California, going to San Diego and trying to chase this skateboard dream.
And how is, so then when you thought, okay, you were going to kind of move over to Boulder and stuff, how was that? I mean, did that then sort of like switch it in your mind where you thought, you know, this is like, boards are getting better. I don't know. Like, you can kind of.
Yeah. I mean, obviously at that point in time, like I said, I was riding for Sims. You know, all of this kind of happened very, very quickly. And so I was on Sims at that point. I really like half pipes were just kind of starting to happen. Basically the dream that I had early on with being able to do whatever I couldn't do on a skateboard on snow was actually coming to fruition because there were all these different tricks that you could try and do on a snowboard in a snowboard half pipe. The boards were getting better, not by much, but they were getting better. And, you know, it was just being exposed in Colorado is so much different. That's just the attitudes and obviously the climate, but the attitudes of people in Colorado was so much better for my mental state than what I was experiencing in Massachusetts at that time. It's Colorado was very much kind of open to new ideas. I mean, they had a whole bunch of resources that allowed snowboarding. It was a very outdoors community.
Yeah,
I mean, even back then, I mean, obviously it is what it is now, but it just was more of an embracing of like, if someone said, I want to be a pro snowboarder, they weren't like they were where I grew up and been like, yeah, okay. And I want to be Superman. You know, you might as well have been saying that to somebody back in the day. So
yeah,
it was just a better place for me to plant roots. And it just having that kind of positivity around you. Like, it's a lot, Colorado was a lot more youthful. Living in Boulder, you're living in a college town. So everyone kind of is the same age. You know, you have a town that's populated by young people. So it was just a different energy than what I was dealing with growing up in New England and trying to make something happen back there.
Yeah. And then everyone's kind of like, like feeding off each other as well, right? When you say,
It just keeps you young. You know, it's like you don't have an opportunity to get calloused, get old, because that constant new thinking is happening all around you, whether it be, you know, bands or art or whatever. You know, there's always something brewing.
Yeah, cool. And how was it when the half pipes started, like, kind of emerging? And
well, I mean, in the beginning, the half pipes that came about were so just crappy, you know. Yeah. But it was the best that we had, so we embraced whatever. You know, there was a couple different places in the United States at that point that took the time to actually shape a perfect wall. Stratton Mountain in Vermont was one. Breckenridge, Colorado had another one. This is pipe dragons or any kind of cutting tool. This was mainly just a big scooper. So some people could get it right. Most people didn't get it right. But that's was kind of the rad part about it, was that if you went to a competition, you went to a resort, or, you know, you heard that there's a half pipe somewhere, you didn't know what you were going to get. It was like back east when we would go and we'd hear about this ramp from somebody in a town, and it was like the notes were on like a napkin, and you'd kind of follow this treasure map to go find a ramp, and you didn't know what you were going to get until you got there.
Kind of like a rave, right? Back in the day.
Yeah. And you just made it work. You know, it was what you had, and those days are kind of what I cut my teeth on. And a lot of riders from back east cut their teeth on it. It kind of gave us backbone. So you were able to adapt.
Yeah,
I can say that.
And then especially kind of like dealing with those conditions as well, with it being kind of pretty hard and icy. And
absolutely. And I mean, once you get to Colorado, I was just like, wow, this is, people think it's hard out today. So, and it was just not even on the same scale as what we considered to be icy conditions on the East Coast.
Yeah. And when did you start competing?
I started competing, I think, in 1989, and it was just kind of through, I think, you know, there was a couple competitions. Obviously, I've left out a whole bunch of other factors that are in this life story, but one of my good friends who basically introduced me to snowboarding and kind of influenced a lot of the people that were in my school that started snowboarding, he was into competing. He was a ski racer, and then he switched over to snowboarding. And so he knew where all the competitions were. He was a lot more plugged into snowboarding at that point than any of us really were. And so he knew where these contests were going to be. So that's when I started competing. It was probably 1988 or 89 at a really grassroots level. I think I did slalom at first. And then there was the very first half pipe in the United States was at a place called Tenney Mountain in New Hampshire. And that was like a pivotal point for, you know, half pipes being made, because up until that point, there really weren't. Oh no. First, maybe it was it's the first half pipe on the East Coast.
Okay.
The first half pipe on the East Coast. There was half pipes on the West Coast, but you know, that was a pivotal point for us, because it kind of like, you know, you can compete doing this. And it was more about like seeing all these different people from all across our 5-state area, even in Eastern Canada, these people would come down to compete. So we were making a lot of friends, networking. A lot of the networking for me was like, oh, you guys have a ramp, you know? So I just wanted to go skate. It was still all about skating at that point, you know, more than snowboarding.
Okay. And then would you say like the competitions, like in your mind, was it getting more serious? You know, when you were kind of, when you were getting on podium and stuff, and then
I think,
US Open in 90 and all that.
I think the first, when it really started to get serious, is when someone handed me a check, you know, and it was like, here, you won $500 for the overall. And at this point in time, you know, $500 was a big deal to a kid who's scrounging for change to get from point A to point B, you know, and just scrapping. So once we started to actually make money, that's when it became serious. And, you know, you get your first $500 payday, then you get your first $1,000 payday. And it's like, you're like, okay, this is, I want to concentrate on this because it's fun and I can actually make enough money to keep perpetuating this Peter Pan lifestyle that I have, where I don't really have to get a real job. I can just follow this circus of friends around and make enough money to make it to the next one. That was really all it was perpetuating that dream.
And were you kind of like sort of seeking out sponsors? Or were you sort of like, was the kind of
vision
was sort of like, if you do well at the events, then, you know, they're going to come.
Yeah, I think, well, in the beginning, after I did well in one or two events, that's when I got on Sims. And Sims was a dream of mine because of Sims skateboards and just because I thought all the best dudes rode for Sims. And this is back east, you know, where it was like real Burton country. So it was a badge of honor to ride for the anti-Burton. So once that kind of started to happen and I got a little bit more in the mix and people started to recognize who I was, I got a couple pictures in the magazines. Then it started to be like, okay, well, now I can start pick and choosing maybe who I want to pursue for sponsors. And that's kind of right around when Moro started. Sims ended, Moro Snowboard started right after that. And I was handpicked for their initial team. But then it was like, you know, okay, well, I can get on Airwalk and then I can get on Oakley. And I think I was riding for Gotcha at that point. So it was like, yeah, you're kind of putting together this hodgepodge of sponsors, like this patchwork. And for me, it was really cool because I think the biggest thing was that I wasn't on Burton. I wasn't head to toe. It was different for me. It was like, you know, it was a lot more skatey where I could have these different kinds of sponsors.
Oh, okay. So, and there wasn't like an exclusive, like you didn't have any like exclusive deal basically where you kind of had to do that.
Like a head to toe deal. No. And I mean, I have, you know, my views upon what that kind of stuff is that, you know, if all of a sudden a company decides to drop you, you've lost all your sponsors. So it's kind of one of those things.
Or if they go under or something, right?
Yeah, totally.
You're screwed.
Yep. And plus also, you know, if you have multiple sponsors that are different companies, each sponsor is piggybacking on the other's advertising campaigns. So it's a great way to get yourself more of a shotgun blast of exposure than like one ad, maybe, you know? So, and I still give that advice to kids these days is I'm like, you know, watch out for the sponsors that are just one umbrella because that, you know, if they decide that you're flavor of the month, cool, they're going to push you. But if you're not, you're not going to get any exposure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And how was that time at Moro? Because you were with them for quite a while, right? I mean,
I was. I rode for Moro from 1990 till about 2003, I think, which is a pretty long time considering in snowboarding. But it was amazing. It was my family. It was, you know, when you come up riding for a company because, you know, you're on the initial roster and you see so many people come and go. And, you know, Rob Moro was like a brother to me. The whole team that we had, we traveled so much together. It was amazing. And when Moro kind of like was sold to K2 and subsequently kind of fell apart after that, it was gnarly for a lot of us to process that because it wasn't just, you know, a paycheck. It wasn't just a board. It was a piece of us, you know?
And that was sort of like what around, I don't know, like late, was that late 90s when that all happened or?
No, when Moro fell apart, I believe it was 2003 or 2004. Okay. That's when all of a sudden, you know, all these K2 bought Ride, they bought a Moro, they bought a bunch of these different brands. And I think Moro just wasn't, they basically had bought three companies that were all kind of, clamoring for market share.
Okay.
And I think they had a hard time, you know, justifying paying. And this is right when like the kind of the bottom fell out of the real estate market and the dot-coms here, when everyone had dot-coms, everyone was making all kinds of money and the bottom fell out of the stock market there. People were looking for places to make cuts and Moro was basically just repeating what they had, at K2 and Ride. So they basically just cut the whole marketing. They kept Moro around as like one of those zombie brands for a little bit, but okay. They cut all the marketing to it. And it was harsh for us big time.
And like a couple of years before that, that was the whole kind of boom era, right?
Yeah.
That was like, I mean, the Olympics and,
yeah, you know, that was fantastic. I mean, we had such a great run. It was, you know, I tell kids these days that are coming up, it was the salad days. It was just like free money giveaway. You know, like people were really clamoring to get into the sport. There was people that were pro that were had only been snowboarding for like a month, it seemed. It was just so weird. Like there was just so much money being spent in the industry.
Because of the Olympics or just because of it was just the rise of popularity? And
I think it was that. I think the Olympics, a lot of people kind of hung their hat that the Olympics was going to change everything and make everything so much bigger and so much grander, but it really didn't do anything to the sport at that point. You know, 2002, things were a little bit different, but in 1998, just by the way it was portrayed at the Olympics, it wasn't a very good showing. So it didn't really do anything. But like if you were one of the people that were maybe favored to win, that run up to the Olympics in 98 was a great time to be a snowboarder for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, you had a lot of pressure on you, right? I mean,
oh God, dude. So that whole thing, I would say like the year and a half run up to the Olympics in 1998 was some of the best of times and the worst of times. I'd say like I was probably riding at my best, doing really well in competitions right up until the time where we had to start qualifying to make the team. And then the first event came because we had three events combined to qualify for the team. First event, I just fell on my face and I was like, oh God, you know, because I had all these crazy bonuses that were like, if I had done well at the Olympics, you know, you hit all these benchmarks and it was a pretty decent payout. I eventually got my shit together that season and got on the Olympic team, but it just wasn't, once I got to the Olympics, it was just a struggle. I had a couple of really good practice days and then just the day of the Olympics, like everything just fell apart. And I don't know if I attribute that to like the pressure or whatever, but yeah, it was crazy. In the finals, I decked out on a McTwist. I was like, I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to win this thing at that point, you know? And I probably went the biggest I'd ever gone on a McTwist and decked out. And that feeling of decking out was the most depressing and the most relieving feeling ever, because I knew that it was off my shoulders at that point.
Yeah.
It was so weird. It was such like a roller coaster of emotions and it really took the chains off a lot of us after that event too, you know, to just kind of open up progression, open up new avenues in snowboarding. So
yeah,
I may not have got the gold medal, but it was a blessing in disguise as far as like what it did for my trajectory in snowboarding for sure.
Yeah. And how would you compare it to like what happened over in Tokyo with, I guess, the hype around surfing and skateboarding and their first time in Olympics?
Well, I would say
now, you know, kind of not being like sort of,
yeah,
on like the commentary side, right? And like kind of looking,
I think surfing kind of experienced what we experienced with snowboarding, because it was, you know, the surf events, you have to have the ultimate conditions to have the ultimate show. And unfortunately, where they decided to have the surfing event was just and the time of year they decided to do it, you're not going to have this incredible show to showcase your sport to the world. Skating was different, though. I think skating was really well represented. Now, of course, the pandemic really kicked that whole thing in the butt, and there was no spectators, and it wasn't, you know. But as far as like what skating showed and the park and the street, I think it was great. You know, I think this next one in Paris with having the skating be, you know, right front and center and having the surfing be at Chopo is going to be an incredible, if they get the waves, it'll be like, okay, this is surfing and that looks scary and that looks incredible. And it should be, you know, what everyone was forecasting.
Yeah. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
And like after, so after the Olympics, like what happened basically to you, would you say to your career, like after that? I mean, that was sort of like, I mean, it just, you were saying kind of, we were just opening up different doors and you thought like, you know, you would be getting more, like, were there more, there was more opportunities coming, or?
Yeah, I think, you know, like for a long time, just the build up to the Olympics was, what we were trying to do is manufacture a run that we could land every single time, basically with our eyes closed. The format changed after the Olympics. It went from two runs combined to three runs best of three. Mm-hmm. And that was after the Olympics. So all this progression started to happen. You no longer had to like just do enough to make it on the podium. Now it was like, we can express ourselves and try one crazy run or two crazy runs before you have to go to the safety run. So all these crazy tricks, Michael Chuck with the double, like I, you know, invented a couple inverted rotation moves in the pipe. And it was just like these different things came about. And then slopestyle began to really take off. And that was for myself, I just really liked riding park jumps, but you know, we really didn't have an opportunity to showcase that in competition. I really, truly enjoyed contests. I loved competition, loved it. So it was like, you know, oh, another thing I can do and compete, yep. You know, with, this is great. So slopestyle came in and then big airs came in. It was just like, it was a lot more started to happen as far as opportunities and ways to go snowboarding in a competitive format. So it was really cool. And then, you know, things kind of really ramped up after 2002, because that was the Olympics where snowboarding was showcased in a way where it was sunny out and beautiful. Red Hot Chili Peppers are playing on the side of the half pipe. There's tons of people there taking, it was a spectacle. And that's really what we were hoping the first showing of snowboarding was. But, you know, they really, really brought the house down in 2002 when it was in Salt Lake. And I think that's where the sport just started to skyrocket as far as popularity with everyone.
Yeah. And wasn't it around then, that was when you had your injury, right?
I think it was actually, it was after that, because I had tried to go to the 2002 Olympics, but honestly, I was having way more fun competing in slopestyle that I wanted to win a slopestyle event. I wanted to win a major slopestyle event. So that's all I was concentrating on, because that was cool to do well in jumps. So I kind of like half-assed my attempt at making the 2002 team and didn't make it, of course, because you have to be all in on those things if you want to do it. So in 2003, I shattered my humerus. Wait, yeah, you can kind of see it right there. This whole thing right here, I still can't feel that. That's all numb. Shattered my humerus where it went into my elbow joint. And it was the first real major injury that I'd ever had from skating in my youth up until snowboarding. I'd never really been sidelined like that. Sure, I'd rolled an ankle or two, but never like, okay, well, you know, you need to take a hard look here at what's happening. Cause the doctor came in and after he had done the surgery, and he's like, you may use that arm again. You may not, because there was so much nerve damage.
How did you do it?
I basically knuckled a jump and put my hand behind me to kind of, I didn't think I was as high up in the air as I was when I was landing. And basically the brunt force of the impact was all taken in that arm, and it just shot my lower arm up through my upper arm and basically exploded it into a jigsaw puzzle of bone. It was bad news. And it was one of those falls where I, you know, initially it didn't really hurt that bad. It felt like someone like gave you like a Charlie horse, like punched you in the arm. And then I remember like tumbling and like being like, whoa, you know, that was gnarly. Like, where are my goggles? And I looked down and I'm like, whose arm is that? Cause it was at such a fucked up angle. It was just so like twisted and weird. I was like, oh, that's my arm. Like, oh God. And that was pretty gnarly. But you know, we have all these different kind of things happen in our lives. And at the time, I was devastated. I was like, I can't do X Games this year. Oh no. But that's when my path kind of intersected with doing the commentary. That's when the opportunity was given to me to come in and do commentary, you know, at X Games because I was hurt.
Yeah.
And then started a whole other parallel path to what I was doing at the same time. So it's weird the way things like that happen.
Did you like it as much, like commentating, like when that first happened? Or
yeah, and I thought it was really
kind of getting nervous as well, right? It would like same in a different, maybe in a different way. You're not going to hurt yourself, but like
yeah, I think I took a lot of responsibility on, because at that point in time we had talked a lot of shit on the commentators. Like they just weren't good. They didn't know what we were doing. They didn't know what it felt like to get in or out of any of these tricks. So when they're trying to explain to a large audience, we're always just like making fun of those guys so badly. So it was a big responsibility of mine to get in there and actually do it from a rider's point of view and do it right. So yeah, I still feel that responsibility to be able to talk to a mom who's never really seen snowboarding before, but also talk to the core and convey the same emotions, the same feelings that these guys are going through.
Yeah. And how would you say it compares between commentating on snowboarding and skateboarding? And
these days I love skate commentary more, because I mean, ultimately skating vert and skating transition, especially like the bowl and vert skating, is really where I cut my teeth. So that is my backbone. That is and to be able to do that, and commentate that, just, it's really special to me. And I'm snowboarding at this point, I feel like I can call 90% of the people's runs before they even drop into the slopestyle course or the pipe. It's just, yeah. I've seen them compete so many times. Is this going to be another double cork, a triple cork? What are we going to see? You know,
yeah.
But with skating, it's so different because a lot of these kids are really young. A lot of skating is spontaneity, depending on how much speed you have coming out of one trick into another. You could get something completely crazy when people get like Eye of the Tiger and like they're having the run of their lives. So that's the part of skate commentary that I really love.
Yeah. Nice. And you were kind of, weren't you kind of going into like different business ventures and stuff with like Archer Brewery? Was that around the same sort of time?
Yeah, you know, it's been a really nice ride with, you know, being someone that's personable and having your ear to the ground and having a lot of friends and all kinds of different aspects of what action sports gives you. Because every once in a while you get opportunities that come along. And St. Archer was a big opportunity for us. As a friend of mine, Josh, who started a company, and he brought in a whole bunch of skaters and snowboarders and surfers to back this brewery. And that was fantastic. You know, it's that to watch something grow from its infancy to eventually get sold off. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was quick as well, wasn't it? It was like a couple of years or something.
Considering how long we were invested in it and how long things usually take like that to gestate, it was a really fast buy and sell. But that's how the beer companies were at that point. The alcohol companies were like, oh, there's someone new coming up. Like craft brew was so huge that we got to get these guys before the next guy gets these guys. And the crazy thing is like we sold to Miller Coors, and last year Miller Coors buried the brand. They just didn't want the cost.
Oh, no way.
So, I mean, you're dealing with these gigantic companies that don't really care. You know, they're buy and sell you and bury you in 2 seconds if it means that, you know, it's not going to take away from their margins.
Cool.
Yeah. It's insane. It's a scary place to be. And there's a lot. The scale is just so beyond what we see in action sports. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And what did you do after that? Was there any kind of like other ventures that you kind of?
Yeah, I mean, like we've kind of parlayed some things here and there. We did a company called Villager, which initially started off as a coconut water, but has since kind of morphed into a canned alcoholic beverage like margaritas and Mai Tais and things like that. So that's going. And then recently I just became part of a Japanese barbecue sauce brand called Bachan's.
Oh, no way.
And it's a good friend of mine, Justin, who his family, it's a family recipe from his grandmother. And it's amazing. And it's cool people. Yeah. And it's something completely different. And I think it's rad. I was already buying it before I even knew that this dude owned it. So to become a part of that is really cool and fun.
Nice. Yeah. And then, yeah, just getting ready for, I guess, for the snow season starting soon. And you're going to be, any trips planned? And
well, right now I think I'm working pretty closely with Quiksilver in kind of an expanded role, to do more of like a marketing role than just like, you know, the team rider who goes off and does whatever, or, you know, in my case, it's like the Legends team rider who they drag in when someone needs to talk to the shops and actually, you know, cause everyone that owns the shops now was like coming up kind of, I was in my heyday. So it's like, I'm in a unique position to actually kind of shoot shit with these people and maybe influence sales. But yeah, it's cool to be able to work in a marketing capacity like that with the younger kids and just do some mentoring. I think, you know, snowboarding is in a position right now where there's not a lot of guardrails. Maybe there should be, because if you don't keep some guardrails and have some gatekeeping to this sport, we're going to forget about the history, where it came from, the pioneers and where all these tricks and all these terminology and all this stuff eventually sprouted from. And also, it'll lose its soul, you know. Yeah. And with forefathers like Tom Sims and Jake Burton gone, who I widely consider to be some of the biggest historians of the sport, they're gone. We're losing the people that actually have, not only a vested interest, but also a desire to keep snowboarding and the roots and who came before the current generation.
Keep its culture
for sure. Because, you know, unfortunately, some of the biggest names in our sport ever don't give a shit about our sport. And that's really unfortunate. You have some people that have gone on to win multiple gold medals who could give a shit less about who came before or what the whys. And so if they're not going to carry the torch, it's got to be people like me. And I'm going to do it because I want to. I love it. I snowboarding gave me everything that I have. So I feel like I owe it to the snowboard community to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And where do you see snowboarding going like next couple of years?
Oh God. Hopefully if
this could be a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully if we all do our job right, and I'm talking about we as in the people within the culture of the sport, I would like to see it wrangled away from triple corks and having it be these mathematic equations that are winning competitions and really putting an emphasis on style and creativity. I think that we're at a crossroads right now where there's only a few super pipes on the planet. So you're not going to expose potential talent to being the next Shaun White because there just isn't enough available for kids to partake in.
Yeah.
So I think we need to start rethinking the formula a little bit. And, you know, maybe making half pipes they don't have to be 22 feet to be spectacular. And, you know, we've been saying this for so many years is let's keep the style in the sport, but it's got to happen because we're losing it. There's not a lot of style. You can put on three flips and a 16-20 worth of spins. It's just not, you can't do it. It's like impossible.
Not enough time, right?
Not enough time. And just by the body physics it takes to whip yourself around like that, you're in a little ball and you're holding on to your knees and that's not stylish. I mean, it's just not.
Yeah. And do you think stuff like natural selection and those kind of formats?
Yeah, I think natural selection is really cool because it kind of opens it up to a broader, I mean, on its face, natural selection is a slope style competition. I mean, it really is. You're incorporating all the different elements of slopestyle, but bringing it into a natural environment. And I think, you know, just having it on that canvas of trees and snow and natural terrain being, you know, massaged into being able to have a slopestyle run in there, I think that's a lot. It's a lot more aesthetically pleasing to the eye.
Yeah.
And that's, like you said, that is style. It's a different style of competition. It's a different style of trick. You know, you're not going to see a triple cork 1620 in natural selection, because oftentimes the terrain doesn't lend itself to that.
Yeah.
And you've got to land with your feet on the ground and be able to get your shit together, because something's coming up, right? You've got to jump right ahead of you. So there's not a lot of time. So I think it's, you know, there will be a lot more kind of creative aspects of like what we consider competition, like natural selection, like Danny Davis's Peace Park, like things like that. I think that's the direction that a lot of people are trying to push this board in.
Yeah. Nice. Cool, man.
Yeah.
And stuff. Well, yeah. Tom, what's the best way, like, if people want to follow like what you're up to, and yeah, how can they?
Well, you can always go to my Instagram, which is @B, Todd Richards. My first name's Brant. Don't ask me. No one's ever called me that except for the IRS and maybe a third grade teacher. But you can follow me @B Todd Richards, and my life is an open book on Instagram, for better or for worse. So you can follow me there. If you're interested in the sports management mastermind, you can go to @sportsmanagementmastermind.com. and get some more information on that. And obviously Quicksilver is has been family for me for a very long time, and so look for future projects coming out of there for us as well.
Awesome. Cool.
Thanks.
Well, Todd, thanks so much, man.
Thank you. And let's just I hope it dumps wherever you are out there. I hope it snows a lot this year.
Thanks man.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. As always, you can find show notes and links to resources on radseason.com/magazine. Hit us up on Instagram @radseasonpodcast. You can follow me on Ollie Russell Cowan. Until next time, thanks for listening.